Committee on Health Policy today, February 9, 2005. And we're going to go a little bit out of order since our first people to testify aren't here yet. And so I'd like to open a work session for the introduction of committee bills. And I'd like to do them in block unless committee members have a problem with it. Is there anyone who would move to move these bills?
Madam Chair.
Or LC drafts?
I move that LC drafts 1154, 1156, 1157, 1807, and 2335 be introduced as committee bills.
Okay, Senator Cruz has moved that LC 1154, 1156, 1157, 1807, and 2335 be introduced as committee bills. Is there discussion? Yes.
Yeah, Senator Madam Chair, as a courtesy, I do have some issues and concerns with them, but having them introduced will allow us to have the discussion.
Exactly. This, if you vote aye, this does not mean that you favor the bill, et cetera. This is just to get, make sure that we can get a bill on. Okay. Those are the opinion that 1154, 1156, 1157, 1807, and 2335 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any opposition? Hearing none, motion carries. Okay, I would now like... Okay, I would like to close the work session on LC... I'm going to close the work session on committee measures. And I'd like to open... Well, let's just go, we're again going to go out of order. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 450. Okay, let's have, shall we have you in both, Martin? Taylor. Okay, so it's, well, I think they're all together. Sarah Breckenridge and Dagmar and all together with Martin. Yeah, we'll just wait. Let's just close the public hearing on 450, and I just want to make a couple of comments on what happened yesterday. We did have a press conference on, I call them the cost containment, the health care cost crisis that we have, and for this is directed primarily for the lobbyists in the group. On February 16th, we're going to start having healthcare cost crisis 101. The discussion's going to start, and we're going to have testimony probably from Dr. Goldberg, Barney Spate, Rocky King, and that will be on the 16th. On the 21st of February, Dr. Goldberg is going to report on a hospital study, and Liz Stevens from AFL-CIO will be talking about how they came up with the bill on February 23rd. Then we're going to talk about negotiations between the hospitals and insurance companies. And then we will be inviting people on the 28th, which is Robert Murray and John Colmers. John Colmers is a program officer from the Milbank Memorial Fund. Robert Murray is Maryland's Health Services Cost Review Commissioner. He's actually the executive director of that to see how their cost containment has worked in Maryland. And I do plan to have, I would like the hospitals and these people from Maryland, hopefully we'll have a little sub-panel, not necessarily a public hearing, to discuss the issues, because I know there's a lot of concerns from the hospitals and how that model won't work in Oregon, and I do want to make it publicly known that we want something that's going to work in Oregon, and this is transparency is a very important issue, and hopefully we'll be able to come up with something positive that will work for the state of Oregon. So are the people here yet? Oh, good. All right. I'd like to open Senate Bill 450, Martin Taylor, and should we have Sarah, Dagmar, Deborah come up too? Usually we have the administrator describe what the bill does, but instead we'll have Martin Taylor describe what the bill does.
I appreciate that. Chair Monson-Anderson, it's very good to say that. Senator Cruz, Morissette, and Courtney, I'm here today on behalf of the AORN and to convey from the Oregon Nurses Association that we're also supportive of this bill. And they're going to ask me to describe a bill wherein I have such experts next to me that I'm going to actually give them an opportunity to do that. But in short, this is a bill that we believe is valuable to the insurance that Oregon continues to have, the standard of care in operating rooms that we currently have. And it's a bill that fundamentally goes to making sure that when you're in an operative procedure, you're getting the quality of care that you deserve. With that, I want to introduce Sarah Breckenridge, who is Oregon's chair of the AORN, and allow you to describe that organization and a little bit more about this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much for listening to us. As you said, my name is Sarah Breckenridge, surgical services manager at Providence Newburgh Hospital, and also president-elect of the Oregon State Council of Perioperative Nurses, which is a part of the national body AORN, which is the Association of Perioperative Nurses. So that kind of gives you a line there. This bill is really important to us in terms of being able to help you understand the environment of the operating room. And I'd like to take you on a little tour, pretending that you're a patient and you're going to have a procedure. As we're getting the operating room ready and you're being admitted to the hospital, you'll be visited by several different people that will be taking care of you in the operating room. One will be the surgeon. His focus is to do the procedure, and so he's focusing on that aspect of it. He's thoroughly prepared you before coming into the hospital. Then there's the anesthesia provider. Their responsibility is to make sure that you don't have pain. And if you want to be sedated or general anesthesia, he takes care of that, or she takes care of that. Another person that will be in the operating room, they'll introduce you, themselves to you, will be the scrub person. That role can be filled either by a registered nurse or a surgical technologist. And they are the people that prepare the field, the equipment, the instruments, the technology of the procedure to get that ready for the patient. And then you'll be interviewed by the circulator. And what we do as an RN is we will assess the patient, the information from before. We will get you ready for surgery. We'll take you on down. And our focus is to focus on you. The others are focusing on parts and procedures, and we're focusing on you as the patient to make sure that everything goes right. We are not a sterile person. We go around, we make sure the equipment is functioning, that we sterilize the dropped instrument or do whatever, and then we're there watching the patient's positioning. We prep the patient, washing the skin off. We're there to support everyone else, but then also, more importantly, we're there for the patient, and our focus is on the patient. Site verification, procedure verification is a very important part in patient safety and making sure that all the pieces are together to make sure that you have a safe and efficient procedure. I've had examples before where it's the RN that has basically stopped or halted a procedure because things weren't right. When they went to assess the patient, one example is an old lady that has a broken hip. They go to assess the patient. There's bruises on the right side, but everything in the chart, everything on the permit, says it's going to be left side. And they're going, wait, time out. And it's through their assessment that they find that there's something wrong, and we need to take the time out. We need to wait before we go forward with the procedure. Have to change the room, do all of that. And they're also the patient, the person that will then, when the procedure is finished, take you into the recovery room, give you a full report to the recovery room nurse, and then transfer the care there. So basically, we're there for you, the others, and the others as well that are focusing on the procedure and the instruments and the technology.
My name is Dagmar Rockstro. I'm a registered nurse in the state of Oregon. I have 27 years worth of experience working in the operating room. I'm here today to talk about my experiences as a surgical technician and as a nurse and what that difference means to me. I began my life as a surgical technician. It was a job that I really enjoyed. I often looked to my circulator as my source of validation and that I was doing things correctly, that I was working efficiently as a team member. I looked for their input. After doing that job for 15 years, I went to nursing school and graduated and began my life as an operating room nurse. To me, it was a tremendous difference in terms of my focus. As a technician, my focus was basically on preparing instrumentation, doing a certain aspect of working in the operating room, but my view, my global view of what was taking place was limited. As a nurse, though, your training is truly and absolutely patient-focused, and this becomes very evident, and when you work in a practice setting, that is what your legal responsibility is. You are there as a patient's advocate. And that was a wake-up call to me, that life would be very different. Even though I was working in the same environment, my focus was purely patient-centered. As an example, when I was a technician, I would rarely have the opportunity to look at a patient's chart in order to see lab results or to really get a global picture of what was happening with that individual. I was busy doing other things. My circulator, though, was the one who would review the chart. As a nurse, I have caught things. I have seen that perhaps there's a lab value that was not brought to the anesthesia provider's attention, and that I would say, you know, are you aware of this? Are you aware of that? As a circulator, I've gone over the correct site surgery with the surgeon and said, all right, we've identified the correct site, and then had to remind them as we're positioning the patient, this is working on the side, not that side. So I'm there as the advocate throughout the procedure. That is my entire focus. And so I see it as a very vital part of patient safety to have somebody with that focus and that attention in the operating room.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morissette.
Well, then the experience, who is an experience in surgical procedures comes from having worked in the operating room, or is there other experience that you, course experience or whatever. Your experience comes from operating in the room, is that right? From having been there, is that what you're saying? From working with the surgeon and getting instructions from the surgeon?
No, not entirely.
Okay.
I think a lot of that educational portion of it comes from nursing school.
Okay.
And that, to me, was a crucial ingredient into how I viewed my role in the operating room.
Okay.
As I said, as a technician, I looked to my team member, nurse, for those bits of information which I did not have.
Mm-hmm.
And nursing school has the function of impressing upon the nurses that they are the patient advocate. That focus comes through nursing school, not necessarily my experiences as a technician. It's there, but I think, and perhaps it has something to do with the legal ramifications, that I'm putting my name on the paperwork, I have liability inherent in my position, and that is to be taken very seriously.
Okay.
Does that...
Well, I guess what you're saying is that it comes from both your training as a nurse and the fact that you get instructions from the surgeon, and over time, now you have obviously been in an operating room for a long period of time, but a nurse who is relatively new to surgery, I imagine, would have to rely on working with the surgeon as much as... No?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
I wouldn't necessarily say that. Your arrangement with the surgeon and the anesthesia provider is more of a collaborative condition.
Okay.
Certainly, I would look to them for any deficits in my knowledge base where patient medical information is not evident to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
follow up, please.
Yep.
Okay, I'm looking at line 5 of the bill, who is experienced in surgical procedures. That's what I'm looking at. And what does that mean?
That would mean a person who has been oriented by a preceptor who is an experienced OR nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And into sometimes it's a 6 to 9 month orientation to be able to take a nurse who maybe has previous med-surg experience or ICU experience, ER experience, and to be able to train them and to be able to become an independent practitioner in the operating room. But the training actually comes from a peer-registered nurse. A little bit different, you're talking about taking direction from the physician. When a procedure is scheduled, the physician will say, I want to do, say, a hysterectomy.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll tell us the procedure, she'll tell us the procedure they want to do, and then what we do is get the instruments, the equipment, everything ready
mm-hmm.
for that procedure. But then as a registered nurse and the information, the perspective we have, is that we know the basic plan of how to do a hysterectomy.
Mm-hmm.
But then we go to the patient's chart. We look at the information. Well, maybe this patient was a smoker. Maybe this patient maybe has a leg that's been amputated, and we're going to be putting them in a special position. We need to do something special for that patient. Maybe this patient has a prior history of TB that wasn't caught mm-hmm. by the physician. We had that just the other day in our own facility. We will take that information and put it together to make an individualized plan of care. The surgeon doesn't deal with that kind of detail because he's focused on what am I going to be doing in the procedure.
Okay.
But it's the role of the nurse to make sure the positioning is correct, that there aren't any, you aren't going to get a bed sore afterwards from the positioning, that the labs are up. We may have a discussion. Maybe we need to hold this procedure because something isn't quite right. But individualizing it to that patient so that when the surgeon comes in, he can come in, she can come in, and his focus in his mind is thinking on that procedure. He's not having to think about, is the bovie ready? Are the stirrups here? Do we have all the instruments? Do we have everything that we need to do this procedure, a special prosthetic or something like that? That is the responsibility of the surgical technologist and the registered nurse, the team that's in the operating room, to make sure that's ready. It is the responsibility of the nurse to make sure the patient is ready and that the things we have are ready for that patient for their best, most safe care.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have a question on line 11 of the bill, and it says a circulating nurse shall be present in an operating room for the duration of a surgical procedure. And I'd heard, or it would seem like you would maybe needing to go in and out of the room depending on whether you had everything in the room or not. Is that literally or that you could not leave?
No, there are times when we run out to get an instrument or run out to get something or, open the door and have someone else call. But it isn't that we're in there all the time, but we're not gone for more than a couple minutes. We can guarantee you that. Because things can change rapidly.
So
the duration would mean from the time the patient's admitted into the operating room itself until we transfer that care to the recovery room nurse. That's the duration of the procedure.
Okay, but the way it's worded is a circulating nurse shall be present in an operating room for the duration of a surgical procedure. And I was just wanting to.
We can run out once in a while or go wash our hands or something like that.
Not with this bill, you can't.
Okay. The intent is that it would follow current practice, and that is that we can run out for a moment, but that there is never not a registered nurse within the very close vicinity of that room that is responsible for that patient. Like, we can't go take a coffee break and just leave the procedure going. No, we have to have another registered nurse come in to relieve us. Okay.
I think you may have identified a technical fix that's needed in the bill, but I think that the intent is
the intent.
That There's a circulating room nurse who doesn't have any other assignments, who's responsible for the assignments of circulating in that operation for the duration of the procedure. Now, in that capacity, they may need to do things related to the procedure outside the room, but they're not assigned anything else. They're not doing a separate function. They're doing something related to that procedure. And if we need to type that language up, I'm sure we'd be willing to do that.
Yeah. Okay, Senator Cruz.
Thank you. What's the difference between a circulating nurse and a supervising nurse?
Do you want to take that one?
I'm a registered nurse who surgical services manager, and that means in our suite, I'm responsible for the management of the recovery room, the operating room, sterile processing, the admit and discharge, and endoscopy units. And it is my responsibility and accountability to make sure that the staff's competent, they have what they need to do the procedures, consultative. If maybe there's something particular on a case, then you know, from my experience, drawing from my experience, helping with them or helping them find the information they need. The circulating nurse is the primary nurse who is assigned to that patient and that will be there through the duration of the surgical procedure. I may be in and out or meetings, like coming down here. We're still doing surgery in Newburgh, but the circulating nurses are the ones that are there with the patient.
Oh. So a supervising nurse doesn't even have to be there?
No. Because there's a whole crew. There's the supervising nurse. You set the tone for it, but then I also have a team. I have a clinical coordinator there that is the other part of the management team. I have team leaders for each of the teams, and they're there as resources as well, too, the one that is assigned to that room, the primary circulating nurse. So it's a hierarchy.
Okay. So theoretically, you could be the supervising nurse of a surgery that's going on at a hospital right now.
I could be supervisor of the team that is doing it. I would never have any patient care assignment or anything like that while I'm gone. That is the primary nurse, that is the circulating nurse, that is a title in, we have the scheduling nurses, we have the team leading nurses.
Okay.
But when you have the assignment of circulating, you are assigned to that patient, that procedure, for the duration of the procedure.
So, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. So the supervising nurse could be supervising several ORs at one time, or basically mm-hmm. like supervisor of a shift, more or less.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The Director of Nursing and...
Yes. Mm-hmm. Senator Morsette.
Okay, thank you. Is there anything in this bill to prevent a technician from being a second circulator?
Nothing, and that never is the intent. The primary circulator would be...
Primary circulator is a registered...
If we need help, it's a larger case, things, you know, bust loose.
Okay.
Yes, a surgical technologist would be...
Because surgical technologists perform some of those functions.
Some of those, we would delegate, we'd make sure they knew what to do and be able to delegate it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Further discussion?
My name is Deborah Turner. I'm a certified surgical technologist, certified first assistant. I work for an orthopedic group in the Eugene-Springfield area. I am a member of the Oregon State Assembly of Association of Surgical Technologists. I am the chairperson of their Government Public Affairs Committee and past president. What I would like to offer today is support of this circulating bill for the RN in the operating room. I do still have some question, though, about the experienced surgical nurse. I know there has been some discussion this afternoon regarding this, and my question about this is I have seen nurses brought in from a medical surgical floor to the operating room and given a very short orientation, and then they're in the room with a surgical technologist, and then, you know, there's not another nurse precepting them. So I would just like to make sure that what is said here today, that they're going to have 6 to 9 months of preception, would actually be what would happen. Because if we're going to say that we are going to definitely have a registered nurse in there that has experience, then I would like to see that happen as a member of the surgical team. I do know there are several surgical programs in this state that do offer training for the RN to actually work in the operating room as a circulator. So I'm thinking that maybe this is what Sarah may have been referring to.
Thank you. Senator Cruz?
Well, I do have some questions. I'd like to hear all the testimony, then maybe we could call some folks back up. I have some confusion on some things, but that's normal.
Yeah. We didn't get the answer to that. I would like to hear the answer to the question that she asked, that Deborah Trainer asked.
Mm-hmm.
The question being, what assures that you have an experienced...
Well, the definition of it.
Circulating.
What's an experienced? I think that comes from several different levels. The hospital is required, as being the agent that employs this nurse, that they are competent in what they do, and so they will set the standards for the training. It is also, we have a lot of resources, as Deb mentioned. One is if you're taking a registered nurse who has experience in another specialty, they can take a course at Mount Hood Community College for a term and then do 6 to 9 months of clinical training that would do that. It's really hard to set a timeline to say you've got to do this for 3 months, you've got to do it for 6 months. What you need to do, and we were just talking about this in our staffing meeting today, you need to assess that individual nurse and what she knows and how rapidly she or he learns. And you've got learning levels that you need to set along the way. And so to set a timeline would be rather difficult. I think what really more, and I know that it's in very general practice, is that we use the AORN standards and recommended practices on and the competencies that are mm-hmm. national standards as to what an independent nurse must do before they can accept an assignment or be capable of doing before they can accept an assignment of a patient and be the primary nurse.
May I?
Yes.
Okay, I'm getting two different definitions of experience. Who is experienced in surgical procedures? Now, I asked the question and got one answer.
Okay.
The question was raised, and I'm getting a different answer. What does it mean to be experienced? Is it going to require some coursework? Is it going to require pulling a nurse in from another area and giving her some instructions, and then she's in charge? The words in the bill are important.
Okay.
I think our intention with the bill originally was that those are the kinds of things that can be worked out in rule.
My
experience generally is that the hospitals in Oregon are following this practice as a standard of care, that our hospitals have been very responsible in this mm-hmm. area, and that there isn't a whole lot of examples of where you don't have experienced nurses circulating in ORs and being in charge of the circulating function. We're less certain about what's happening in ambulatory surgical centers, and we certainly have experiences in other states where the standards have been, we call this de-skilling, where a non-nurse has been put in that role. But the concern that's being expressed isn't one that is heard broadly out in the hospital community. And I know the hospital association's here, you can ask them that same question.
Okay.
Maybe I'll broach this now because Martin's kind of brought it up, and we've had conversations about this, and it's, you know, Senator Morissette's correct. Words do matter, mm-hmm. and that's what we work in as words here. But I'll operate under the assumption that most hospitals, this is standard practice. I'm not sure that that relates necessarily to all A and B, but that's a whole other matter, and it gets to staffing availability and things like that. But for me, the wild card in all this is the ambulatory surgical centers, which are a rather new creation, and the definition of surgery in those settings, which we talked about, because they do some things that may not rise to the level. And so I guess the concern I would have would be to require a circulating nurse when somebody comes in to a surgery center, because it's the only place they have to go to have a broken leg set or something like that. So I guess, you know, I'm just wondering if we need to be clear as to what we're talking about when it comes to actual surgery, more in that setting. I mean, clearly, if you go into a hospital with a broken leg, they take you to ER, they set it. But a surgery center, it's such a new dynamic, I don't think we've got really our hands around what indeed it is. And so those are some of my concerns that I'm thinking it would be nice to have addressed or at least spelled out so that it's understandable.
Deb was just suggesting the word sterile invasive procedures, because there are procedures that you do that are not that invasive. Sterile invasive procedures that require either conscious sedation, meaning some IV drugs that are put in so that you're just a little bit, you know, unaware of what's going on, along with some pain meds so you don't feel some local, so you aren't feeling it. So that's a sedation, all the way to general anesthesia. All those where there's multiple things going on with the patients and you need to have multiple professionals watching those aspects of the surgery.
Maybe I could just try to add a little clarity to what this bill does and doesn't do. This bill actually doesn't make a distinction between major and minor surgeries. What it does is makes a distinction between settings. It regulates the operating room and obstetric procedures where rooms where obstetric procedures are going to be performed. It doesn't cover a doctor's office. Most of the things that you would consider minor surgeries could be performed in a doctor's office. The reason that you would take it from a doctor's office to another setting would be a minor surgery would be concerned about that patient's individual health. They have additional problems. They're underweight. They have a contagious disease. They've got whatever additional symptoms that would require them to have the precaution of being in an operating room. I think the nature of your question is really, in the case of a surgery center, is there a clear line between the doctor's office and the part of a surgery center which is an operating room? Is that something that you folks feel comfortable addressing?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, but when you look at the amount of people in the state that don't have primary care physicians, and they either end up in clinics or a center for whatever it is that they need to be done, you know, just... I mean, you know, I just, you know, I'm just a simple country boy, and I'm trying to make sure that I understand what we're doing here. And I don't think right now, for me, there's enough clarity here, and maybe there's something we could do to address that. So, when we talked about that, so.
I'd just like to make one last statement as we close, which is that one of the reasons that there is a push in Oregon to do a bill like this, despite the fact that our hospitals are doing the standard of care right now, is that nationally there is a standard that's lower than this. It allows non-RNs to circulate. And there's a great body of evidence now that there are risks attached to that. A major report was done around wrong site surgeries, which are essentially the very worst case scenario, or among the very worst case scenarios in an operating room, where literally the procedure was done on the wrong body part. Those are avoidable. They should be 100% avoidable. I guess there's always a human error factor, but one of the ways you avoid that is you have a circulating nurse whose job is not to look at the individual body part, it's to evaluate the entire procedure and the patient. And they've got a whole set of protocols, which I've produced for you, that go to how do you prevent a wrong site surgery. And one of the most obvious things that could be said about this is if there's someone whose job it is explicitly to prevent that, i.e. the RN circulator, they have the function of calling what's known as a timeout. And timeout sounds sort of silly, but it's a technical term now in operating rooms. And it literally is where the nurse supersedes the surgeon and everybody else and says, timeout. We gotta do this all again to make sure that we haven't made a mistake. It can be done for any number of reasons, but it's really intended to prevent this issue of wrong site surgery. Mm-hmm. That's been one of the reasons that, and you'll see a whole list of states where this kind of legislation has already passed, that we're attempting to make it very clear that this is the standard of care that best prevents patients from having a variety of bad things go wrong, including wrong site surgeries.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I'm just a simple city boy. But I'd like to tell you my experience of having a hip operation. And I opened my eyes, and who should I see but Deborah Turner, who is a surgical nurse. And I said, Deborah, I'm glad you're here, because I've already had an operation on one side, and I want to be sure it's on the right side. And so she gave me a marking pencil, and I marked the side. That's oversimplification, but she was my on-site protector in that particular instance, and she was there. So I understand how important that is, because it does happen. That's the worst case scenario, is that you go in for an operation and they remove the wrong part, and that has happened. So I understand that, and I think that's important. So.
Okay. Thank you.
And if you need any other questions, we'll be in the room.
Yeah, we have two more to testify, Joe Bell and Scott Gallant.
I know. That was a nice comeback, Senator.
Yeah. No, Deborah Turner. She's a good surgical technician. They're trying to get recognized, but they're not. Is that all right? We ought to do something about that. I'm sure they're just walking on there. And she's been, she's working with them. So,
good afternoon, committee, and Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. I think the previous discussion has pretty well taken care of most of my testimony, but I do want to maybe give a little flavor to some of it. To begin with, we surveyed our members to discover how prevalent this these standards are, and almost all of our members responded, small, medium, large, urban, and rural, and all of them indicate that they have that's their standard offer. Operations of practice to have an RN circulator, and that they were pretty much unanimous on continuing that process, and that in many cases the entire staff in the operating room outside of the surgeon is RN.
So state your name, Joe Bell.
My name is Joe Bell, and I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. That was written down. I thought I'd already done it. therefore, we really can't see any impact on operations in Oregon hospitals and not any increase in cost. However, we do kind of question why we need this bill if it's the current standard of practice and something that all the hospitals are expecting to continue. And the other thing, too, is we always have a little bit of a fear about putting anything into statute that could vary widely from location to location. And as times change and practices change, that once it's in statute, then if there is a need for moderation in the policy, then we have to come back to the legislature for changes, and that may not be necessarily a good public policy to operate that way. Some of the members, including several of our small rural members, brought up some of the issues that you mentioned. You have already mentioned. One of them is the duration of the procedure, and while one of the ladies who was testifying sort of outlined for that, there's a feeling that maybe it needs to be more clear, because I had questions from individuals. You know, is this from the cut time to the end of what the surgeon does, or is it from cut time to close? And I'm not an RN, so, you know, I'm repeating what they said to me. And what about the entry of the patient into the room until they get to the recovery room? Because sometimes having the patient moved into the room may not be done by the circulating nurse, but by the scrub nurse, and would that limit that? And so what is the duration of time? And then the other issue is present in the operating room at all times. Almost everyone responded that they do have, like, storage rooms adjacent to the ORs, and that frequently the circulating nurses need to leave to take care of that one particular patient. And being a little bit literal, they were concerned that might be a problem, and that would create some issues if they had to remodel and reorganize so that they had everything that they might need in each individual operating suite. And then in one case, a rural hospital indicated that they have a surgeon or a couple of surgeons who bring their own teams to the OR, and while the hospital does assign a circulating nurse to those, the physician's team may very well also have a circulating nurse, so that individual is not necessarily there the whole time, but is there to assist that team. So it's a little bit different process than what we normally think of. And then the final question is, again, something that I think Senator Cruz brought up, and that, what is the definition of a surgery? A couple of the smaller facilities indicated that because they're small and they don't have a large volume of surgery necessarily, they also use their ORs for things like mole removal and lesions and stuff like that. And they want to make sure that we are specific about what a surgical procedure might include. And then, finally, to the training and the term experience that Senator Morissette brought up. The concern is that almost all of the ORs that I'm familiar with, they spend a great deal of time training new nurses from other areas to work in the OR, and that it really does vary the time and duration. The length of time that it takes to train them really does vary based on where the facility is, what kinds of surgeries they have, and So like in a small facility, if you don't have very many surgeries or if you have mostly one particular kind of surgery, somebody might be in training for a fairly long time. So, and then the other question is, once someone is trained adequately and has had the preceptorship and that of a current OR nurse, then when would they be considered experienced, their first, second, or third time as the actual circulating nurse on the process? So those are some of our concerns, and we thank you for your consideration of those. And we really don't oppose this measure, but we do question the need for maybe having it in statute.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead, Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm representing the Oregon Medical Association. I also have some of the same concerns that have been raised by others so far, among those being what experience does in fact mean, and also what it really means about being in the operating room during the duration as well. I think you have to make a distinction between different types of surgeries. You're going to have a different, by necessity, skill level for heart transplant teams versus surgeons who perform and other teams who perform orthopedic surgery and other types of surgery. So there's going to be a variation of experience and requirements necessary for those types of procedures. This proposal suggests that even for minor surgeries, that you would be required to have a circulating nurse present for those surgeries, as we read the bill, and we would suggest that there is a need for clarification in the legislation, if you're going to move this legislation, to really clarify the parameters of the bill. The bill could and probably should, and maybe the proponents may provide the committee with current Medicare requirements, JCO requirements, what the standards are for accreditation of ambulatory surgical centers, for circulating nurses and operating nurse staffs currently. I think it would help provide some flexibility that the bill does not currently provide as it's drafted. Mr. Taylor was kind enough to give me a copy of a variety of states, not very many, Colorado, Idaho, Maine, New Jersey, Wisconsin, New Mexico's statutes that allude to or reference surgical nursing staff and circulating nurses. And there's quite a variety of language used in each of those statutes, and it doesn't appear that there is any real uniformity, at least so far, in the state statutes that are referenced in other states. So I would encourage maybe the committee as well as the sponsor of the legislation to try to make some differentiations and provide some flexibility so that there aren't unnecessary additional costs that might be associated with having a blanket requirement that would not necessarily be appropriate.
Discussion. Senator Morissette.
Could you tell us the standards that you referred to, JCO and others? Could you go through that one more time? These are federal standards.
They're federal standards. JCO has standards for JCO all hospitals, and there are a number of accreditation organizations for ambulatory surgical centers, which most surgical centers, and not all of them, in Oregon do in fact meet currently. And as the sponsor of the bill indicated, they don't believe that there is a current problem, whether it is inpatient standards, and I don't believe they're aware of any current problems in ambulatory surgical centers. I think their desire is to assure in statute that circulating nurses would be present during surgeries in case there is some possible, I guess, change in standard of care down the road. I would argue for flexibility where there might be improvements over time, but that's just a personal observation. And you can use the language of the bill itself. You know, the previous discussion was confusing, I think, to some degree. It was to me in listening to it about even in the definition of what a circulating nurse meant, since the words managing nursing care is used, but the description of the responsibilities of a circulating nurse actually in the operating room seemed to be quite different than a supervising nurse, as raised by Senator Cruz, or other responsibilities of other surgical nursing personnel on the team in the process. So I don't know how this bill integrates with the current standards that hospitals, ambulatory surgical centers are required and to meet, and how that interplays with those teams. But I think it is something that the committee would want to inquire of the sponsors of the bill to provide you in order to add clarification to its requirement.
Okay, Senator Morsa.
Would you please inform the person who's testifying that he violated the first principle of our new committee standards? What does JACO mean?
It's the federal joint accreditation, joint committee.
How good. It's Joint Committee on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations.
Been using it so long, I never repeat the whole
thing. Yeah, I think it's Joint Committee. Committee is the only word I'm not sure. Joint Commission, yes, on healthcare, on accreditation of healthcare organizations.
Okay, now, may I go?
Yeah.
Now, I think Scott was suggesting that we take a look at those standards as a basis, perhaps, for the bill. Is that what you were suggesting?
Right. I mean, as I understand it, at least all major, if not all the hospitals in Oregon, are JACO accredited. But
okay.
At least the major facilities are. And then again, you know, they are required by regulation of the Health Division and others on meeting appropriate standards for providing surgical services.
Okay. Thank you.
And that would include circulating nurses.
Okay.
I don't plan to move this today. I would like the proponents to work with the opponents on
opponents concerned parties.
If you would work with them, and Ms. Bell and Mr. Gallant, if you would work on what would make it agreeable to you with Mr. Taylor, and then we'll look at it maybe next week.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I guess I would like to see special interest on, since we're defining circulating nurse, what that means, because this is somewhat vague, and I would like to see a definition of a surgery. I mean, if it's major surgery, minor, you know, what that means, and clearly, I think it was pointed out, Section 1 sub B is a problem, period, because it would not allow the circulating nurse to go to a storage room. So there are some language problems in what is here, and I would like to see some of the things that aren't. So.
Okay. And also a further clarification, what impact would this have on ambulatory surgical centers? Yes, Ann?
Well, there was some discussion about experience, and you know, we mentioned that it varies from place to place of necessity, and some people may not have a lot of opportunity to learn in a room, in an operating room. So I would like to, that better defined, I would like to have experience spelled out in greater detail. As long as it's going to be written in statute, we have to know what those things mean, is what I'm saying.
Okay, I'd like to close the public hearing on 450, and I would like to open a public hearing on 407. Rick Rakobian, please summarize the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 407 authorizes a licensed psychologist who holds the Medicare prescription authority to prescribe medications, requires State Board of Psychology examiners to adopt the competency standards for licensees, identifies minimum standards to receive the prescription authority, establishes a Council of Psychologists formulary to basically put together a formulary under which the medications would be covered. Allows membership compensation expenses for attending meetings. Allows the board to collect fees for issuance and renewal. In brief, two states currently have a statutes that allow prescription authority for psychologists. New Mexico, which was passed in 2002, and recently Louisiana in 2004. There are variations of those from this bill. Currently in Oregon, psychologists are not allowed to prescribe medications. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Damiana Merriweather. What's the name? Pear Feldman and David Wade. And I do know that Angela Kimball, who was here to testify, she's still in the room, and you have to leave by 2, but I'm not sure we're going to get...
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Damiana Merriweather, and I am the lobbyist for the Oregon Psychological Association, the Professional Association of Psychologists in Oregon. And I am here, I've brought 2 psychologists with me to provide prepared testimony, and I am here to answer questions, technical questions about the bill, and to discuss with you the one amendment that we have requested for the bill, and I can do that whenever you want.
All right, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. David Wade, and I'm a clinical psychologist working in Hood River, and currently I'm working with Providence Hood River Memorial Hospital. I'm the lead clinician of an outpatient program there. I have completed my postdoctoral master's in clinical psychopharmacology, and so I have some knowledge about the bill and the process which we're looking to support today, which is Senate Bill 407. And what I'd like to do before I get into talking about specifics is have Dr. Feldman also introduce himself, and we can take it from there.
Okay. My name is Paul Feldman. I'm a psychologist practicing in Portland. I also graduated from the same master's in clinical psychopharmacology program as David. Both of us are currently being supervised by Robert Julian, who's a physician in Portland, whose letter is being distributed to you for this bill. I'm also president of the Oregon Society of Clinical Hypnosis and an adjunct faculty member at Pacific University. Thank you.
All right. There are a number of areas I'd like to cover today, or we'd like to cover. And again, Senate Bill 407 is allowing a limited prescription authority to licensed psychologists who have adequate training. And first off, one of the big questions comes up is this a need? Does this need to happen? And the other is, can this be done safely? And I think these are two very important questions. First off, I think nationally and within the state, we're in a we have a mental health crisis, and this can be seen with the closing of hospitals and numerous people falling through the cracks who are not getting adequate mental health treatment. And so, in terms of needing something to help bridge the gap, I think this is definitely an issue. There's also the issue of not having enough psychiatrists, because if we had enough psychiatrists to meet the need, I don't know that this bill would be presented at this point. But unfortunately, we don't have enough psychiatrists to meet the need. Consequently, as was reported by the Oregon Medical Association, 70% of the psychotropic medications are being prescribed by primary care practitioners, which includes MDs, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. And as we'll talk about, there's some real limitations there due to these folks being overburdened, but I certainly commend primary care practitioners trying to do what they can for their patients given the lack of psychiatric care available. I also will want to talk about training of psychologists, and get into talking about the importance of prescribing specific medications. Psychologists have doctoral level training, and what we're looking at is getting additional training on top of the doctoral level training in order to prescribe medications. And let me just give you a couple examples of where this has been a problem for me working in Hood River. I had a case a couple years ago, and this is not an uncommon case, where I had a woman give me a call who was in having high anxiety. Her heart rate was going very fast. She thought that she was going insane, very uncomfortable. And I talked with her for a little bit, and she calmed down a little bit, and I found out that she had stopped taking one of her antidepressants, an antidepressant called Effexor, about 4 days prior. Well, one of the things that I know about Effexor is that if people just stop this medication cold turkey, they're apt to have withdrawal symptoms. They're called discontinuation symptoms. Now, I was aware of this, and I talked with her, and I said, you know, this is what I think is going on. You need to talk with your psychiatrist. And she was in such bad shape, I said, I'll call the psychiatrist for you. So I called the psychiatrist who worked for County Mental Health, and the psychiatrist wasn't on call. So I was given a master's level therapist who said, oh, well, have her call me, and I'll tell her what to do with the medication. And I said, well, you know, that's unethical and that's illegal. I'm not willing to do that. So what I did then was I called the patient's primary care practitioner was not on call. They weren't available. So then I called the backup physician, and there were two things that happened there. Number one was the backup physician didn't know anything about Effexor, so he wasn't comfortable with saying what to do with it, did not know me, and so I think he did the reasonable thing, which he said, well, you need to take her to the emergency room, because he didn't want to make a judgment call on not having enough information. And what limited me is I could not tell her, okay, just this is how you should start your medication again, because that would be practicing medicine without a license. She did tell me, she said, oh, well, I'll just start it back the dose I stopped at. And I knew that that was a bad idea, but again, I can't tell her how to take her medication. Other situations where this kind of issue has come up is I do a lot of work with children. And I have a number of kids come into my office who are on stimulant medication. And I do believe stimulant medication can be very effective with properly diagnosed children. And for some children, it works very, very well. The problem I'm seeing is that there are a lot of kids being prescribed medications that should not be on medications, you know. And physicians really are not in the position to do a comprehensive assessment when they have maybe 8 minutes to assess the situation. And I've seen anxiety disorders, depression, a divorce, sexual abuse. All these things can manifest as symptoms of ADHD. So consequently, I'm also concerned about a lot of mismedication going on. And again, I don't fault the PCP, primary care practitioners, because I think that they're between a rock and a hard place. So in terms of trying to bridge this gap, psychologists in the state and nationally have proposed prescription authority for properly trained psychologists. And what that is, according to Senate Bill 407, what we're talking about is a psychologist having postdoctoral training in clinical psychopharmacology, a minimum of 350 hours post-license hours of classroom study, which includes neuroscience, pharmacology, psychopharmacology, physiology, pathophysiology, physical and laboratory assessment, and clinical pharmacotherapeutics.
Dr. Wade?
Yes.
Senator Nelson has just walked in, and he's in another committee. Can we just put you on hold for a minute and let him come up? And
you bet.
And
whatever you'd like is wonderful.
And Representative Barnhart had wanted to be here, but he is sick today, so he will not be testifying. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29. I represent Umatilla, Morrow, Union, and Wallowa counties, and I was one of the persons that sponsored this bill. It was brought to me by one of our local psychologists, and it's mainly an issue of access from our viewpoint. And you know, we have a long distance to travel. We have issues with people getting the proper treatment, and I know you've got some certifiably smart people here that will give you the background on it, but I just wanted to come in and testify the reason why I brought this bill forward, because I thought the discussion needed to be had. You know, how do you provide this access to this medical care, particularly in areas like myself? And then as I found out, maybe there are other areas of the state that maybe are not so rural that have the same issues. So that's where I'm at. I'm not an expert in this field, and I just appreciate the opportunity to come in and testify.
Thank you. Any questions for him?
No,
thanks, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Senator.
Get back to the good stuff here.
Okay.
May I, before we get back, I just want to tell the good doctor that I did introduce a bill at the request of Jim Wittenberg to tighten up the standards for kids being prescribed for Ritalin, for instance. Mm-hmm. But the original bill in the previous session required a psychologist to make that determination, and that did not fly. So we wanted to make sure that a qualified physician make that determination rather than a doctor having someone put pressure on them to do this because it's insists that your child be medicated. And so I understand the importance of qualified people doing this kind of diagnosis, and I wish we could have had qualified psychologists.
Oh.
I'm sorry. Okay, and so I wish that we could have had the qualified psychologists to determine the psychotropic drugs for children. We're also looking at that for college students now, the whole suicide syndrome, and whether or not college campuses are dealing with it adequately. But I do appreciate your testimony, and thank you for the opportunity to mention this.
Well, thank you very much, Senator.
Continue.
All right. Well, and I'm going to jump back a little bit to the issue of access. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, then I'll get back to the training, because this is an issue. Living in a rural community, I'm fortunate to work with a psychiatrist who's on staff in our clinic. There have been times when she has been booked out 6 months, and 6 months is just not all right. So consequently, again, a number of the folks need to go see primary care practitioners who are put in a jam of needing to prescribe. And so having psychologists who can prescribe is going to have a better access for patients, and also to monitor, because as Senator Morsetti stated, he talked about the suicide syndrome with antidepressants. Well, this is a big concern right now for adolescents and children in particular, and if you have a physician who sees an adolescent, puts them on an antidepressant, can't get them back in for a month, in my opinion, that's way too long, because what we've found is if there's a problem with the medication, and there certainly always isn't, but if there is, it typically comes around the time when they first start the medication, or when they're increasing the dose, or when they're coming off the medication. So again, this is a very important access issue. Getting back to training, I mentioned a little bit the classroom hours and so forth, and this type of program takes about 2 years to complete. Then in addition, there's following this would be supervised clinical practicum of treating at least 100 patients. And to do this would at least take a year, I would imagine. So here we are up to 3 years of training in addition to passing a nationally certified exam in psychopharmacology and then continued education. The other piece, too, is keeping in mind that the issue of being able to prescribe is the ability to take somebody off medication. And I'm going to go back to the issue of children. I've seen children who should not be on a stimulant medication. They don't need to be on a medication. And being able to take a child or take somebody off medication, I think, is very important. And so we're not just talking about putting people on medication. And again, I think that if a primary care practitioner has somebody who's depressed, they're not going to have time to do psychotherapy with this person. They're going to put them on a medication and probably send them out the door. And again, with their limitations, I don't think that you can fault them. Whereas a psychologist who typically meets with people 50 minutes a week has an adequate time to do a very comprehensive assessment and continue to monitor that patient in terms of how they're doing emotionally, socially, and if they're on medication, how they're responding to the medication. There's been an issue of a question of safety has been raised, and I think, again, that's a very good question because I certainly would not want to suggest something that I did not think would be safe. And one of the arguments that I've heard is that psychologists do not have medical training. They haven't gone through an MD program. And currently in Oregon, we have nurse practitioners, psychiatric nurse practitioners, physician assistants, optometrists, and dentists all safely prescribing medications who have not been to medical school. Also, we have in the military, there's been a program that was started 11 years ago, which they had a number of psychologists that they trained to prescribe medications and have been prescribing medications. And these folks have been under the magnifying glass because the military's been looking very closely at, can they do this effectively? Can they do this safely? And what they've found time and time again is that they've done an excellent job, and I believe that you probably have some references on this evaluation of psychopharmacology demonstration project analysis, and I think they have those, don't they? Okay. All right. So there is a lot of support suggesting that this can be done effectively and safely. In addition, I know in 2000, the former Surgeon General David Satchin actually endorsed the idea of prescription privileges. And the article that I read on this had to do with, again, the healthcare crisis. We have people who need medications who can't get medications, and we don't have the adequate people who can meet that need. One of the things that I've found also with psychiatrists, and I think this is a demand issue, is most of the psychiatrists I know do not do psychotherapy. They do med management. Now, that's not the case for all psychiatrists. But again, I think it's the issue of having so many people that need psychiatric care that a lot of them have gone just to managing meds. And what research supports is the most efficacious approach oftentimes is a combination of medication and a combination of psychotherapy rather than just doing one of those. Psychologists are trained to work collaboratively. That's our paradigm. We don't work in a vacuum. We work with physicians. If I have somebody come in and I think that whenever I have somebody come in, the question is, when did you last have a physical? When did you last have blood workup? If I have somebody who's clinically depressed, I need to find out, okay, is there a thyroid disorder going on here? Is there some other medical condition that's happening that may manifest as a psychological disorder? So consequently, I'm talking with the primary care physicians and getting my folks in to have medical workup so things aren't missed. And I think by doing this, it provides better continuity. It provides continuity of care by a psychologist doing this. And if we're able to actually work with physicians and prescribe medications, I think that provides even more continuity of care because you have the person then not always bouncing back and forth between the psychologist and the primary care physician. You have a psychologist, let's say, treating the patient with therapy and also psychotropic medications, and the psychologist is in contact with the physician just to make sure they're on the same page and things are going as they should. I think also providing access is going to meet, as I said, fewer visits. This means less out-of-pocket expenses for patients because they have fewer office visits. I think for Oregon Health Plan folks, if we have people on the wrong medications, if we have people seeing multiple providers, that's costing the state money. And so, again, having more providers that can meet this need in kind of a cohesive manner is going to save costs. In addition to other things like less travel time for the patient, probably less time work missed work if they're doing better.
Okay. We have seven more people to testify, and we need to be out of here in about 35 minutes just to give a time frame.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much. You have some things that you'd like to share as we're going along here?
Rather than consuming more time, perhaps I should ask if any of you would like to raise any issues with responding.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, just a couple things. Madam Chair, thank you very much. The standards that are listed in the bill, in a vacuum, I'm not sure what they mean. When you talk about a total of 350 post-licensure hours of classroom study, is that a standard somewhere that you have adopted into the bill?
Well, Senator Cruz, all of this is organized in response to the military training that was conducted at the Department of Defense. That's sort of our paradigm for thinking about these issues. The people who went through that training, who were so highly evaluated by the people with whom they were working, are sort of our examples of how to do this right. It's based on that training that we came up with these different areas of education, and based on that training and direct involvement with some of the people who went through that training that we worked out these numbers.
Okay, you follow up? Mm-hmm. Okay, so... No, I'm assuming, I mean, it's here, the areas, but there would be very specific classes that would have to be done. And in the B, you have completion of supervised clinical practicum, supervised by who?
Supervised by a physician.
Okay.
In the case of our direct experience, Dr. Julian, again, whose letter is in your packet, has been meeting with us on a regular basis. And I might say we've been meeting with him for 2 years. And in that time, I've completed 20 supervised patient cases. So I have 80 to go.
Okay. Sub C has passing a national certification exam.
That exam is written by and administered by the American Psychological Association.
Okay. And the other two small points I had in the bill were Section 2, Sub 4, when it says that the board shall issue a certificate, which means that there's no discretion by the board, and then when you get over Section 3, page 2, line 13, which basically says that when your formulary committee creates the formulary, the board has no choice but to adopt it. There's no byplay into that decision, and that's something I would question, too. Because what's the purpose of the board if not to have ultimate authority, and this takes away their authority. So that's just an issue of concern. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Could I just speak to that for a moment? I think one of the areas that this does get covered by the board, though, also is the Board of Psych Examiners. They have the charge of making sure that we're operating legally and ethically. And so I would speculate that if there was a concern, that would be a discussion then between the board and the formulary group to take that into consideration.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I guess from my perspective, if the board's the ultimate authority and you're taking away their authority in this language, I would question that. So.
Any other discussion?
I have a quick question.
Thank you, Chair. Is there any analysis or feedback from New Mexico on how it's worked there? Have they reviewed or provide information on that?
Neither New Mexico nor Louisiana have actually been up and operating long enough for any information to come back. Although the bill was passed in New Mexico some time ago, it was not implemented until 3 months ago.
Madam Chair, the only other item I have is more of a housekeeping item. We have requested an amendment, which is not returned from LC, in response to what appears to have simply been a drafting error in the bill. On page 2, lines 2 and 3, as a part of the formulary board, there is a pharmacist who would be included there. Our intent was for that pharmacist to be appointed by the Board of Pharmacy, as the other professionals are by their appropriate, and that has been in consultation with the representatives from the Pharmacists Association. We want to fix that, and we have made that request. We simply haven't received that amendment yet.
Okay. Thank you.
May I say, Madam Chair, that in the miraculous occurrence that testimony is finished before 3 o'clock, and there's the opportunity for us to return to respond to comments from other parties, we'd be delighted to do so.
Okay. Well, yes.
Madam Chair, if I could, there's just one point I'd like to also include, because I think this is a concern that has been raised numerous times that I'd like to address, which is I've had people say, what if a patient has a medical problem that's beyond the scope of the psychologist, and what if the psychologist misses the medical problem? And I think this is an excellent question, and one of the issues is this is already being addressed, because currently I work with many people who are on medications and many people who have medical conditions. So consequently, I'm looking at those things. However, as a psychologist, I'm not their medical doctor, okay? But if I see things of concern, I'm going to go ahead and address those. A case in point was I had a person arrive who I'd met just a couple times who was not able to walk very well. They had difficulty with articulation and memory, and it looked neurological to me, and I was very concerned, so I arranged for this person to be transported to the emergency room. That person was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And so is this kind of thing that we're already looking at? And again, as psychologists, we're not asking to be a primary care practitioner. We don't want to do that. We want a very small area of specialty that we think we can provide safely to the public to help our patients.
Okay, we're going to move on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And I would like to call up John McCauley, Teresa Shelley, and Robert McKelvey, but I know Angela Kimball has to leave too, so what's your preference? Come up.
Ms. Kimball.
Okay, and John, you can come on up too and be ready to go, and then as soon as Angela's done, then Robert McKelvey and Teresa Shelley can come up.
Chair Anderson, members Monis Anderson, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. Recently, we polled our directors on their position on Senate Bill 407, as we anticipated that they might have concerns regarding access to providers and prescribers, and we might have a range of positions on this issue. However, the responses we received were uniform, and I have been asked to convey their thoughts. From Columbia County, we have a mental health director who says, we have psychiatric nurse practitioners who provide an excellent service for the majority of our adult clients. But for the adults with complex medical issues and children, we only use psychiatrists. I would be very concerned about psychologists' lack of medical training. From Benton County, I would not support this. I think it's a dangerous precedent to set, especially with the concerns I already have about overuse of medications with children. From Douglas County, although we have a real shortage of medical providers, especially for kids in Southern Oregon, and this could seem a potential solution, I have to oppose this legislation. We have noticed that in order to reduce hospitalization, we need doctors that are very experienced in pharmacology. And from Lincoln County, this bill could potentially add serious burden to community mental health programs already having to deal with cleaning up crises. And as the parent of a child with a serious mental illness, I can only concur with the opinions of our directors. The prescribing of psychotropic medications is complex and can have profound consequences. consequences that I would be loath to hand over to those who have not undergone appropriate medical training. By way of personal example, I can add that my son spent years on a medication that required regular blood draws and analysis of the blood work to determine whether liver functioning and other functionings were appropriate because of the potentially lethal side effects of his anticonvulsant medication. And in addition, my son is profoundly affected, for the better, by a medication to address the attention deficit disorder that accompanies his bipolar disorder. However, a recent and very small increase in this medication set off a manic episode in which my son wrote furiously for an hour, then left his high school and wandered through Portland for 5 hours, contemplating how to kill himself. The very medications that have contributed to so many individuals' recovery from mental illness are also, as I have alluded to, potentially dangerous. A concern echoed by mental health directors throughout our state. Our directors do not need any more crises. We urge the committee to consider carefully their implications and ramifications of this legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCulley representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association. I would ask Dr. Shelby and Dr. McKelvey to join me, and I'll start my presentation. Information I think is being handed out to you now. Our organization opposes Senate Bill 407, and we will, in the next few minutes, describe the concerns that we have with this legislation. The first point I want to address is the adequacy of the training. And you heard from the previous witnesses about that training. I would like to describe, as I understand, what is involved here. There currently is a provider of a postdoctoral degree in clinical pharmacology that I understand is operating in Oregon. It's a school in California called Alliant International University. I'm not sure if anyone has taken that training or not, but I've gotten information about that program. It's actually 432 hours instead of the 400 or 350 hours as indicated in the legislation. When you think about it, it is a two-year program. It's done on weekends. It's distance learning. From our standpoint, is not clinical training at all. I would be very concerned about that. The bill does not establish any standards that are required for the people who are offering these courses. There are no requirements for accreditation of those courses. The last bill you heard, you spent a lot of time talking about standards and accreditation. There's none associated with this, at least as specified in the bill. That would be a concern. The other issues that I would like to raise deal with access. Before I get to that, let me say I've handed out to you this side-by-side comparison of the training for a psychiatrist and a psychologist, and I have used in this example the Alliant International University training program, the 432 hours that would be required. And I think this gives you a good idea of the medical training that is involved for a psychiatrist versus the very minimal training that would be required to establish in this bill ability to prescribe psychotropic medications.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Marcet.
Okay, and I appreciate this. Who presently can prescribe this kind of medication? A primary care physician. What kind of training do they have in this area? Wait a minute. And who else can prescribe it? Can nurse practitioners? And can clinical nurses? No, nurse practitioners. What kind of training do they have, as opposed to psychiatrists, or I mean psychologists and medical doctors and so on?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, the primary care physicians, look at this, would have everything except the psychiatric residency that's included here. So they have completed medical school. I probably should let doctors discuss this rather than me. But they have completed medical school, which does include psychiatric training during that time. As a part of, for example, their family practice residency, there is mental health training that is a part of that residency because so many family care, primary care physicians do see people with mental disorders. So I would never sell short the training, the medical training that is received by primary care physicians. Psychiatric nurse practitioners have a master's degree in nursing and then additional training to prescribe medications. But I think the key point is, and the chair knows this much better than I, that training is medically based. And that's the issue that we have with what is being discussed here.
Excuse me.
Follow.
What are you looking at for physicians for primary? You're not looking at this chart for the primary care physicians.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris said, I don't have that in a chart yet. What I do have is through medical school, which would be similar.
Okay.
Maybe I should defer to Dr. Shelby or Dr. McKelvey, who could discuss that and see if I missed anything there.
I'm Dr. Teresa Shelby, so I'll just respond to the question, Madam Chair, Senator Marsette. I believe the primary care physician has a three-year residency after medical school, so all up through medical school for the primary care doctor would be the same, which is on that chart that you have, and then their three-year residency would include some psychiatric mental, emotional exposure, but also, you know, a much more medical, surgical, pediatric focus than ours. So there'd be some differences in those internship residency years in the focus. But basically, there's much more similarity than difference.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'll try to wrap this up as quickly as I can, because I know you have a lot of folks who wish to testify, Madam Chair. I want to talk about the access issue, and I appreciate what Senator Nelson is saying and the issues that he deals with in the rural parts of the state. But I think it's important to note that psychologists congregate in the same urban areas that other practitioners do. And to say that by passing this legislation, you are going to encourage psychologists to practice in rural areas just isn't true. There is no requirement in the legislation that people go to rural areas to practice, and I included a chart that shows where people do now practice in the state. It includes a listing of psychologists, family practice physicians, internist psychiatrists, physician assistants, and psychiatric nurse practitioners. And I think it's very graphic looking at this that there are some parts of the state where psychiatrists practice and psychologists don't, and vice versa. There are places where psychologists are and psychiatrists aren't. But there are normally family practice physicians who are available there. One point I want to make here is that there is assistance for those primary care physicians who have questions on psychiatric medications and patients they may be working with who have mental disorders. Oregon Health Science and University has established a helpline that has been available for several years. It's toll-free, where any physician in the state can call and get a curbside consultation with a psychiatrist. Our own organization, the Oregon Psychiatric Association, for the past 15 years has operated a referral line. We have 60 doctors throughout the state who are accepting patients, and we receive calls from the public, we receive calls from other primary care physicians who are looking for help for their patients, and we are able to provide that through our referral line. So we don't believe that access is the major issue. It is an issue. I'm not going to argue with that. It is an issue. But we believe that there are steps underway and already in place to take care of those questions. Madam Chair, with that, I have a lot more I could say, but I think it would be better for you to hear from the
We're going to obviously come back again, because we don't have the amendments, and we're not going to have a work session. But you mentioned the word curbside, which is a descriptive term. Maybe an unfortunate term in terms of qualifications of primary care physicians, but my concern is that some doctors don't take the time to consult with the mental health experts before they do prescribe psychotropic drugs. And I'm not taking the side of the psychologist particularly, but I think that seems to me that that's their primary mission, and for them to consult with a psychiatrist or an MD would be equally appropriate. I appreciate, though, your enlightenment, and I will do my homework before the next session, because we will be back, and any additional information you could give us would be helpful. Thank you.
Do you have further comments?
I'm Dr. Teresa Shelby, as I said. I'm representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association also. I am a child psychiatrist, and I have a practice in Beaverton, and also work at Morrison Center and LifeWorks and Donald D. Long Detention. And the Oregon Psychiatric Association strongly opposes this bill. We believe that medication should be prescribed by professionals who have had thorough and broad training in biological and medical science. We'd like to stress that the mental disorders that are treated with drugs, which are, you know, depression, schizophrenia, bipolar illness, ADHD, those are all brain disorders, and very much connected with the general state of health and the entire body. And all those medications have effects on the entire body system, not just the brain. It's been mentioned that many psychotropic medications need lab monitoring, blood counts, liver enzymes, all these kind of things. We do not think the proposed psychologist training would prepare them to interpret this. From listening to the previous speakers, it sounded like they would still be counting on the primary care doctors to kind of interpret those things and look out for those things and monitor those things. And given that, it seems to me that this would not take a lot of responsibility or work off the primary care doctors if they still have to worry about the thyroid and the blood sugar and all the other things that can go awry. Psychotropic medications can cause or aggravate a great number of physical problems, including diabetes, blood pressure changes, high cholesterol, thyroid problems, kidney problems, liver problems. I can go on and on and on. That's a very long list. And all those things need to be going through the prescriber's mind at all times. And like if the patient's taking a medication, they get a skin rash, and you look at it, the only way I know how to decide, do I need to stop that medication or not? Is this just a nuisance skin rash, or does this mean I have to stop that medication right now and get the patient to the hospital? The way I know that is because before I was a psychiatrist, I was a medical student and an intern and saw all kinds of skin rashes and know something about that. That exposure and that training and that depth of knowledge is not going to be present in this psychologist curriculum. They're going to have little to no training in the body as a whole. And neither their clinical classroom, whether it's web-based or weekends, whatever it is, it's not comprehensive enough. It's not going to cover all the subjects that physicians take. So you'll start from organic chemistry, biochemistry, cell biology. I could go on and on and list those. And this is just a very superficial overview for people that, by and large, probably didn't even major in a science, in a biological or a laboratory science in college. Everything I say about the caution and the judgment that's needed, I would just stress that even more for the vulnerable populations of children, the elderly, and medically fragile patients. And Dr. McKelvey will talk to you more about children, but that is, you know, even more difficult and complicated. There are no safe, simple psychotropic medications that could be put on a formulary. There just aren't. And it's in flux and it's subject to change. You know that there's been all the controversy about the FDA and the Prozac and Paxil for kids, and is it safe, is it not, and we still don't know. And things can change in an instant. Another example is that there's a medication called Strattera, which is used for ADHD, and that's been out a while, and it was thought to be very, very safe. And then all of a sudden, about 2 weeks ago, we're notified there have been some cases of extreme liver problems appearing very suddenly in individuals with on this medication. And so it's a whole new ballgame with that medication. and you have to be alert for the patient developing liver problems and jaundice. And as physicians, we know what jaundice looks like because we've seen it many times, but psychologists are not going to have that exposure, so that's why it concerns us.
We have about 15 minutes, and we have, so if you could...
I'm going to go very quickly. John's already mentioned your packets with a comparison of the training and a geographical distribution. We do respect psychologists greatly and work with them and rely on them all the time. We just don't think they should be venturing into the medical part of mental health care. In terms of the rural access, we already do have nurse practitioners and physician assistants able to prescribe, and so one might wonder why aren't these practitioners plugging the gaps in access, and we think it's partly because a lot of the problems with access, both rurally and in the urban areas, isn't because of lack of practitioners, it's funding issues, it's being uninsured, organ health cuts, poverty, all those other things which psychologists prescribing isn't going to impact, and hospital beds closing, psychologists prescribing is not going to impact. So we acknowledge there are huge problems with the healthcare system and the mental health care system, but we don't believe this is the answer. So I'll stop and...
Madam Chairman, Senators, I'm Dr. Bob McKelvey. I'm Professor of Psychiatry and Director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at OHSU, and I appreciate very much your offering us the opportunity to testify on a matter that is very important and very close to my heart. I'm going to focus on the dangers of this legislation to a particular population, children and adolescents, with whom I've worked for many, many years. The leading principle of medicine is first do no harm. It's not treat, it's don't harm the people that you treat. And I think that is a principle that is absolutely ingrained in the bones of physicians. After over 30 years in psychiatry, the aspect of my practice with children and adolescents that causes me the most healthy anxiety is prescribing medication. The reasons for that are that although children can be helped by medications, and they can often be helped very much, they can also be harmed and unfortunately killed by the inappropriate use of medications. The practice of child and adolescent psychopharmacology has grown immensely over the years that I've been in practice, and the increasing complexity and the number of medications that children are often on is staggering. It's not at all unusual to see children and adolescents on four different psychiatric medications at one time. It takes a person with extraordinary training and expertise to manage those medications together safely. Children and adolescents are especially sensitive to the side effects of medications and more likely to develop them than adults. And those side effects can often be hazardous to their development and growth. An example of that is using stimulants in ADHD. They retard growth, they cause you to lose weight, they increase your pulse and blood pressure. At some point, you have to decide as a prescriber how much of this is acceptable and how much of this is going to harm that kid in 5, 10, 15 years. Only a physician can make that decision. You've read about the FDA's decision regarding SSRIs and depression and suicidality. Let me say another thing about SSRIs. They interact with hundreds of different medications, and these interactions through complex enzyme systems can be very detrimental to the health of children and adults. I'd like to, if I may, just give a few examples of the high stakes that are involved. About a month and a half ago, in my capacity as a consultant on the wards at Dornbecker, I saw a 17-year-old boy who had been taking risperidone, and risperidone had essentially destroyed his pancreas. He is now diabetic. So that's a side effect that can really contribute to shortening and making more painful this boy's life. In the 80s and 90s, a number of children died from the prescription of desipramine because of its effects on the heart. are psychologists trained to interpret EKGs, and are they trained to recognize the signs of impending cardiac problems in children? I doubt that very much. All of the medications that we use to treat disorders in children are associated with severe and at times life-threatening side effects. To recognize them, whether it's a rash, an arrhythmia in the heart, jaundice, elevated blood sugar, you have to have medical training, not a few hundred hours of online learning and supervision by some kind of physician. We're not even really clear what kind of physician is doing that supervision. The only way to protect children against medication side effects is to utilize medications very cautiously and judiciously, monitor them closely, and be able to recognize and treat their side effects. To do that, you need medical training to do it thoroughly and well. And I'd like to end on just giving you an example of how this training philosophy is implemented at Oregon Health and Science University. After 4 years of medical school and 3 years of full-time psychiatry residency, general psychiatry residents come to us for child psychiatry training. They spend a year with us, 1 day a week. They're closely supervised by us. At the end of that time, we do not believe, and they do not believe, that they are prepared to treat children with medications, despite the years and years of medical training they've had. If they want to do that, if they want to work with our most precious resource, they have to spend another 2 years of full-time training with us. Oregon's children deserve the best that they can get, and nothing less. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. So what kind of continuing education do you have for your primary care physicians who have been practicing for 30 years and are prescribing psychotropic drugs for kids?
They attend. I present at a lot of conferences, both nationally and in the state. When I give lectures on the problems that primary care providers are most likely to see. In terms of pediatricians, the two of the five most common problems that they see in their office practice are ADHD, which they're very, very thoroughly trained to recognize, and adolescent depression. So I give lectures on those, and I give lectures on common psychiatric problems and the safe prescription of medications. The thing that frightens me about psychologists is that they haven't had the medical training to be afraid of what they're doing. When I talked to my close colleague, who's the head of pediatrics at Dornbecker, and told him I was coming down here today, he shook his head and said, I'm scared to prescribe these medications. It's the lack of that element of healthy fear and healthy anxiety that you get in medical training that's completely absent from a guy who takes an online course and has a few outpatients supervised by heaven knows who.
Okay. That didn't answer my question.
And just okay. To let you know, I would like to have Tom Dodson testify and then see if we have questions, because we have 5 minutes and then we'll need to be...
Mandatory training. Maybe we need a bill that requires MDs to go back and take these classes if they're going to prescribe. That's what I was getting at.
Thank you. If I can call Tom Dodson up, and then if you could stick around just in case we have then a few more minutes.
They don't require that. That's true. And we're having a lot of physicians.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a short prepared statement, and I'll just read that if that would be okay. And any questions that you all have, I'd try to answer to the best of my ability. Thank you for the opportunity to provide my thoughts on the matter of psychologist prescribing. I finished my psychiatry residency 18 years ago. I think it is a mistake to...
Introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Tom Dodson. I'm a general adult and forensic psychiatrist. Yeah, private practice in Portland. I think it is a mistake to pass psychologist prescribing legislation. Psychologists under this bill would have inadequate training to make risk-benefit determinations about prescribing medications. I don't think that this bill will enhance public health or lead to an improvement in the treatment of mental illness in the community. The risks of medication treatment for mental problems are significant and potentially life-threatening. During my training and subsequent 18-year career, I've seen a variety of serious drug reactions that were life-threatening. I saw one case of Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which was where the patient's total body surface was peeling away. I've seen several cases of reduction in white blood cell count that required immediate referral to a hematologist to assess. I've seen several severe muscle spasms that impaired the ability of patients to breathe. I have seen abnormal spasms of musculature that interfered with the capacity to swallow. I have seen fainting on low doses of medications that caused physical injury. I probably assessed more than 20 patients who had changes in electrical conduction that fortunately did not die. I've seen a patient who was comatose from an elevated lithium level and almost died. I had a patient who received the wrong strength tablets of medication and almost died. I've seen two patients who suffered kidney impairment as a consequence of lithium treatment. And I've seen more than 1,000 patients who suffered permanent involuntary movement of their lips and tongue from long-term use of medication. I've seen 3 or 4 cases of severe agitation caused by Prozac, and I've heard of patients who died of heat stroke related to medication side effects. I've treated probably more than 200 involuntary total body spasms, which required immediate intramuscular treatment with medication to relieve. And I've treated probably more than 2,000 patients who had impairment in their consciousness and delirium, in part related to treatment with medication treatment. I've also witnessed the enormous benefits of medication. I've treated about 3,000 patients who had life-threatening depression that likely would have ended in suicide or death had the assertive use of, without the assertive use of psychiatric medication. I've seen probably 1,000 cases of patients with psychotic symptoms like hallucinations and delusions who were assaulted or who assaulted others and who, when properly medicated, were able to control their impulses. I've probably seen 100 cases of delirium tremens, which were alleviated with intramuscular medication that likely would have died if not instituted promptly. And I've seen probably 1,000 people who were extremely psychotic for days having a full resolution of their emotional problems with medication. I have had about 500 patients who had marital disputes in part related to psychiatric illness that, when it was adequately addressed, went on to have enhanced relationships with their spouses. And I've seen about 200 patients with panic attacks that made them go to the emergency room fearing heart attacks. And most of these had complete recovery of their symptoms with appropriate medication. I've had about 20 patients with bipolar illness so severe that they did not sleep for more than a week, and it went on to have a complete return to normal functioning with mood stabilizer treatment. The decision whether to recommend medication needs to be made in light of the understanding that fully the potential of medication to help and the potential risks to avoid. A psychiatrist's training entails them to assume responsibility. And we see approximately 8 patients per day when we're in training. Over the course of 4 years, that adds up to about 10,000 patients. Throughout the course of 4 years, residents gather a lot of experience which can be utilized to make the often difficult decisions associated with assessing the risk-benefit ratio. The psychologist training under this bill is inadequate to permit them to accurately assess the risk-benefit ratio in regards to treatment with medication. I oppose Senate Bill 407 because it puts the prescription pad in the hands of those who won't have enough supervised clinical experience to utilize it wisely.
Thank you very much. I would like to say to the proponents, there was Scott Gallant from the Oregon Medical Association, Tom Holt from the Pharmacy Association, and Martin Pidiani from the Board of psychologist examiners who, when we hear this again, you will we will let you know, and you will have the opportunity to come back. But I do think that you need to look at this issue of the formulary and more clarification on formulary, because it seems like that is the greatest concern regarding there's a wide variety of mental disorders that may need to be clarified, and I know this is what you wanted your counsel to do. I think you need to also look at your counsel or and think about, rather than having one physician, in increasing maybe the membership of a psychiatrist or another physician. But those are things that I would like you to take a look at and hopefully work with, I guess, the lobbyists, John, to see if you can come to some consensus on how the bill could be more palatable to those who have concerns. All right. Yes.
Yeah. This has opened up the whole new.
I'll have to adjourn, and so
area for me, and that is the ongoing education of physicians, because that's what really struck home, is that the average primary care physician needs to have some ongoing training in psychotropic drugs. That's what I'm getting out of this.
Yes. Thank you. And the meeting's adjourned.